Funding for Think comes from SMU's Informal Courses for Adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the true nature of 21st century American capitalism? Thinkers across the political spectrum tend to extol the virtues of our free market system. But what defines that free market in the first place? Economist James K. Galbraith would argue that we've created not so much a free and competitive market as one where systems built to benefit the middle classes actually create profit for the wealthy. He calls George W. Bush's America a corporate republic, where rather than reducing the size of government in traditional conservative style, the emphasis is on funneling public money to private industry. James K. Galbraith is Lloyd Benson Chair in Government and Business Relations at UT Austin's LBJ School of Public Affairs. His new book is called The Predator State: How Conservatives Abandoned the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. James, welcome to Think.
Thanks very much.
One thing that becomes clear in this book is that what exists today and what we call the free market has really not served us as well as we've led ourselves to believe.
I think that's fair to say, although I would argue that the term free market is really a misnomer for the American system and has always been, or at least has been for the last 80 years to a century since the start of the New Deal. We've built an economy which has a very strong component of public action, and the strength of it has been the collaboration of public and private sector in the pursuit of common objectives. That's how we got two-thirds or more of American households into their own homes. We have actually one of the highest proportions of college-educated people in our population of any country in the world, a whole series of accomplishments of this kind, which are partly public and partly private. And the problem that I see as having developed over the last 30 years in the name of the free market has been that these programs and institutions have been increasingly diverted to the benefit of very small, of very wealthy clienteles who have taken control of the government in very important respects.
There are many people who argue genuine benefits to be derived from, and this is just one component of this, but privatizing certain functions of the government so that the government is not specializing in things that might just as well be handled by the private sector. What do you think about that?
The private sector has its place. I think that let's just take the example of our system of higher education, which is a combination of some excellent public universities. I teach at one of them, the University of Texas at Austin, with extraordinary private universities supported in large measure by charitable donations, which are tax deductible. And I graduated from a few of those, so I know how good they are. The rest of the world can't begin to compare to that combination. But if we are talking, on the other hand, about, let's say, security functions that should have traditionally been provided by the uniformed military being turned over to private contractors at much higher cost, paying large overheads, and without the discipline and controls that the public servants who are military officers and soldiers are under, then you can expect problems and you will get problems.
Let's step back for a minute and define a little bit more clearly the idea of a predator state. Is the state itself the predator, or is it just a facilitator for private industry and corporations to prey upon the American people?
I think it's the latter is a very good summary of the thesis, that the instruments of the state have been taken over, and particularly the regulatory structure and the procurement structure have been taken over by interests who are not following the free market libertarian ideal of dismantling the state and letting private enterprise do the whole job. They recognize that that's not a realistic proposition, and it's certainly not a proposition the American public is prepared to support. So what they've done instead is to, as I say, largely divert the public resources into private hands and greatly enrich themselves in the process.
What puts industries in the best position to get these sorts of favors from the government and these kinds of contracts and deals?
Well, if your former chief executive happens to be the vice president of the United States, that can't hurt.
You're talking about Halliburton.
Just for example, of course.
Yeah. But seriously, I mean, obviously there's a very strong lobby component. Is it fair as a defense to say, well, these corporations are functioning in a sort of dog-eat-dog environment? If everyone else is doing it, they have to jump on the bandwagon and do the same.
The function of a strong and effective public sector is to keep that kind of activity under control. When we went into World War II, Franklin Roosevelt, who was president of the United States, said, I don't want a single millionaire to be created by this war. It's not the purpose of the war to make people rich. The purpose of the war was to defeat Hitler, to defeat Tojo, to make the world a safe and peaceful place. And that had to be accomplished by everybody pulling together. Now, in peacetime, of course, you want an economy in which there's a great deal of scope for private initiative. But the state should not be the instrument of private entities gaining inordinate wealth and advantage over everybody else. And that's the problem. And I think, you know, it's very interesting. I think conservatives I've been around the political game for a long time, and I was in the forefront of opposition to the conservative takeover of the government in the early 1980s under Ronald Reagan. But the people one was dealing with then in the administration, and I name some of them in my book, many of them have become my friends in recent years, seriously believe that what they were doing was going to produce a better economic result from what had gone before. And while they were using the free market and the private sector as their instrument, they had a larger public purpose in mind. And that's entirely missing, and has been for the last 8 years, from apart from the most surface rhetoric of this administration. And that's been really well recognized by some of our country's most prominent, best respected conservative commentators.
Well, you're arguing that even the most public programs, things like now we have, you know, the Medicare drug policy, basically exist so that pharmaceutical companies can benefit. I'm wondering ultimately what the motivation is for the government officials that make all this possible.
Oh, I think you'd have to ask them or just track their careers after they leave. In some cases, of course, the officials come in from the companies. After 1994, when Newt Gingrich's Republicans took over the House of Representatives and Tom DeLay rose to power, we had something called the K Street Project. What that amounted to was a system in which, in return for supporting the power of those politicians, lobbies basically got to write the legislation themselves. And what had previously existed as an element of professionalism, independence in the Congress, a professional staff that was concerned to hear all sides of the story, almost totally disappeared. And so what then happens, of course, as I say, some people come into the government directly from the industries. That's true all through this administration. And, of course, after their term of office, they will go back. And they will go back to industries which have been protected and enriched to an enormous extent by the policies that they've pursued.
My guest is James K. Galbraith. He is Lloyd Benson Chair in Government and Business Relations at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at UT. His new book is called The Predator State: How Conservatives Abandoned the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. James, why has what we have today been so easily, if you want to use the word, disguised as a free market state?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think there's a rhetorical habit that's involved. I have to give a lot of credit to the framing of the issue 25 years ago in the Reagan years, which was an act of genius from the standpoint of political marketing of ideas, with the prestige behind it of very prominent and well-respected figures at the time, people like Milton Friedman or Friedrich von Hayek, a phalanx of lesser folks who, as I said before, in many cases seriously believed they were not hypocrites or public relations people exclusively. They were people who were seriously convinced by the ideas they were advancing.
So it was worth trying, at least.
Well, was it worth trying? I never thought it would work. But I have to say, there was a serious group of people behind it, and the power of those ideas, which do have an intrinsic appeal and an underlying logic, was very strong with a lot of people. And so I think that's part of it. But the other part of it, there's a huge responsibility which falls to the opposition, to people like myself who are liberals, who basically decided that they would concede this essential point and that liberal policies would be dressed up in a garb of deference to the concept of the free market, that they would always say, oh, I am a free market person, but I think it could be made to work a little better. And then they would start listing some of the ways in which problems could arise without ever coming to grips with the reality, which is that once you do list all of the ways in which problems can arise, you find that problems arise basically everywhere with the underlying concept, and that it doesn't, and you lose touch and you're out of contact with the reality of the actual economy, which is one which has dealt with those problems by creating this closely linked public and private sector enterprises. And that, to me, has been bringing that reality into focus is the first step to developing policies that can bring our economy back into a state where it's really functioning effectively.
What's so interesting about the use of that term, especially by liberals, is that it sort of worked the other way as well, because even at its sort of height, and when people were really talking about a lot of sort of laissez-faire policies, no one seriously talked about eliminating things like Social Security and Medicare and even Medicaid in most cases, or public education. So that baseline has always existed. When did what caused the balance of power to shift?
In which direction?
Well, to shift toward the more predator state, where suddenly you still have these programs that exist, but suddenly they exist, in your opinion, really to bolster the wealth of these corporations.
Well, I don't think Social Security exists to bolster the wealth of predators as it stands now. Social Security, as it stands now, is a great survivor of the New Deal system, still effectively run and very efficiently run by a government agency that takes in the payroll taxes and processes the checks. Social Security has been, since the beginning, the target of insurance companies and stockbrokers and others who would like some of that business, who would like basically to have a larger market for life insurance, or to have the funds that come in from payroll taxes and the fees that would come from placing them in the stock market, commissions for trading and that kind of thing. And so that's been a constant feature of the battle over Social Security since the very beginning, dressed up in a lot of talk about how the system is unsustainable or is going bankrupt, which is manifestly not the case. It's actually financially in very good shape and quite sustainable. But we get a lot of scare talk, which motivates calls for cutting back the benefits and then turning things over to the private sector. And that is what, if it's not vigorously resisted and clearly argued, sets you on the path to a kind of a predatory takeover, such as we saw to a certain degree with the drug benefit in Medicare, as you've already mentioned, in which Congress prohibited the government from negotiating with the companies over prices that would be charged. So they were opening up a conduit into the public public treasury for the drug companies that would otherwise not have been there, and for which there was no good reason.
James K. Galbraith is my guest. His new book is called The Predator State: How Conservatives Abandoned the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. We'll return to this discussion after the break. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is James K. Galbraith. He's Lloyd Benson Chair in Government and Business Relations at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at UT Austin. His newest book is called The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandoned the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think at kera.org. I don't want to spend too much more time on this, James, but I want to go back for a moment to the idea of Social Security, because we're told all the time that it is not solvent or won't be solvent, that it can't possibly hold out and beyond the baby boomers. Do you think those calculations are deliberately misstated to convince younger people to move away from Social Security and to embrace something that would be privatized?
I think they are deliberately misused to that effect, yes. And I think they are also that the actuaries don't have a good argument for the extreme pessimism of the economic projections that they use to come up with the estimates that they have. Those estimates are for an economy performing markedly worse for the next 50 or 75 years than it did in the last 75, including in the Great Depression. So it's not really plausible that that's going to be the case. A more reasonable and realistic set of projections, there's no Social Security shortfall at all. But even if the relatively modest shortfall that they prefer to use occurs, that's not a reason for panicking about the program. The benefits can and will continue to be paid. And the standard of living for on Social Security for retirees a generation from now will be considerably higher than it is today, because the economy will be much more productive. So it is just a systematic scare tactic campaign carried out by a group of people who've been intent for many years on undermining confidence in Social Security, and there is no warrant for it, in fact.
So as a population, for us to be preyed upon by these corporate entities, these private entities in this predator state, there has to be a certain amount of wealth available in the first place. Isn't that right?
Oh yes. There's no question that the economic system that we have in this country generates an enormous amount of wealth. And I would attribute that to the success that we had in blending a pretty effective and dedicated public sector to the private sector. I'm not, in fact, a fan of socialism. The idea of having the government in complete control of the economy produces all kinds of rigidities, difficulties, and ultimately it is rejected by every population that lives under it. But I'm also not a fan of the idea that you can have a market without the government, because that doesn't give you any development at all. The government has to be involved at all kinds of levels, providing research, support for research, providing infrastructure, education, health care, protecting the environment, setting standards for occupational safety. These are all part of the interaction between the government and an economy that really is capable of doing sophisticated things and managing advanced technologies. We wouldn't be able to have, the fresh vegetables that we go and buy in the grocery store if the government were not there setting standards for how clean they have to be and giving people confidence that you can, in fact, take the lettuce home, give it a rinse, and eat it. And if you go live in China or India or lots of other places around the world where those systems don't work, you find nobody eats fresh vegetables for that reason. They cook them because their presumption is that they're contaminated. That's the kind of thing where you have the private sector is doing a lot of the work, but it's doing so in a framework that is provided by government, which gives people confidence that the market mechanism isn't going to be corrupted.
You would like to see additional wage controls beyond minimum wage?
I think it's quite reasonable to set standards for wages. And I like the idea of living wage standards, which basically say that if you work full time, you should not be living in poverty. I think the minimum wage should be substantially higher than it is. And I think the effect of that needs to be understood. What happens if you let the minimum wage drift down too low is that you're providing, in effect, a kind of subsidy to a lot of businesses which are, in fact, very inefficient, which are not at all, would not otherwise be competitive. Raising wages, not abruptly but gradually, puts pressure on businesses to become more efficient, and the whole economy moves up to a higher standard of living. It's actually very interesting to look at how this operated in small country contexts. It was 70 or 80 years ago that the Scandinavian countries started applying a policy of more equal wages and higher minimums, and they found, as they did so, that their industries became more productive and the standard of living for the whole country went up. So far from being a trade-off between equality and efficiency, up to a point, maintaining standards for equity helps your economy maintain its efficiency to grow more rapidly. And that is an argument that I make in the book, and I think the evidence for it is pretty strong.
Do you think living wage needs to be regionally set, or is that inherently unfair as well?
I think that I'm happy to see pilot projects. I think you can set it. There have been a number of campaigns at the municipal level. There was one in Houston a little while ago. There was one in New Orleans. Out on the West Coast, there have been a number of them. And I think that's a good way to begin. It helps, though, to have the broader the area to which it applies, then the less likely you are going to have race to the bottom developing, where some towns try to lure businesses away on the grounds that they can give a discount on cheap labor. So broader standards are not always, but often better.
So I guess you'd have to create a formula based on the cost of living in each region and sort of go from there.
It certainly helps to take into account what the cost of living is, no question about that.
James K. Galbraith is my guest. His book is called The Predator State. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak to Patty in Garland. Hello, Patty.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a comment about Social Security, and if it were privatized, I believe that the company would look at life expectancy and maybe, you know, reestablish a different point, because when the Social Security Act was enacted, the life expectancy was 65, and now it's much longer than that. I don't think Social Security was meant to be paid out for such a long period of time.
James, does it still work if we all live to be 90?
I think it works if we all live to be 90. I think one of the reasons we are able to live to be 90 is that we have Social Security. Up until 1972, actually, well into the lifetime of the program, one-third of America's elderly were poor, and they didn't live all that long. What happened in the 1970s was a substantial expansion of benefits as a result of actions taken by Richard Nixon in the 72 election. And the poverty rate for the elderly dropped to below 10%, so that they're actually one of the least, the incidence of poverty in that group is one of the lowest in any age group in the country. And as a result, of course, they live longer. They have more comfort, less instability. They're not as vulnerable as they were. And it's just one of the great success stories. Can we continue this? There's really no reason why we can't. And the problem of taking the Social Security away would be enormous inequities that would develop between those elderly who have children who are willing and able to support them and those who don't. The latter would be left out. And similarly, amongst the working population, people who have parents to support would suffer. People who don't have parents to support would be better off because they wouldn't be paying any payroll taxes. And what Social Security does, I mean, and effectively does, is even out those burdens on the working population, the benefits to the elderly population. It's an insurance system, and it's one which is, I think, I share with a former colleague of mine, Ken Apfel, who used to be the commissioner for Social Security, the view that it really is one of the best retirement systems in the world, and its effects on the welfare of the elderly population have just been dramatic.
When you have unchecked predation in the wild, eventually those things that are preyed upon die out, and then the whole thing crumbles because there is nothing for those at the top of the food chain to eat. Is it the same way? Is this system ultimately unsustainable?
Well, I think actually when you have unchecked predation in the wild, yes, you're right, you can drive down the population of the prey, but you also get a crash in the population of the predators because they no longer have anything to eat. And that, you know, you can see that in the oceans or in the rainforest today. And that is an enormous source of instability. You can't eliminate predatory behavior. Human society is, to some degree, intrinsically affected by predatory conduct. But you need to keep it under control. You need to stabilize it. A great example of this is in the banking sector, where our big government-sponsored companies, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, created a secondary mortgage market for housing and for people who qualified for those guarantees, vastly expanded the home ownership in the United States, all across the country. What happened in the last few years, beginning really in 2004, 2005, was a huge expansion of mortgages to people who didn't qualify, on terms that were intrinsically abusive, in which people were given low rates for 2 or 3 years with a very obscure provision that the rates would jump up after 3 years. And that happened, and of course that was the onset of the foreclosure crisis that is sweeping the country. Well, it tends to drive down the value of housing all over, whether that housing was based on subprime mortgages or not. And when that happens, the financial institutions lose not only on their subprime portfolios, but on their whole housing portfolio. And Fannie and Freddie are also deeply affected by this. So in some sense, the big fish have to have a stable and healthy population of small fish. And that's the job of the government, is to try and keep these things in balance.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. James K. Galbraith is my guest. The book is called The Predator State: How Conservatives Abandoned the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. Let's go next to Max in Duncanville. Hi, Max.
Hello. Yes, I was wondering what you think it's going to take for America to wake up and realize the income disparity and all the problems the middle class has and the wealth disparity, and go towards a more egalitarian society like in Europe?
Well, I think America is awake. That's my sense of it. I thought it showed it was awake in the 2006 elections, and it was plain that the leadership of the Congress was dreadfully corrupt, and people said, forget it, get them out of there. And that happened, really to the enormous surprise of the commentators at the time. I think in this last political season, we've seen something very interesting, which is the mobilization of much larger numbers of people to participate in the presidential campaign than I've seen at any time in my lifetime since the early 1970s, when the Vietnam War was a big issue. And a lot of that was based upon exactly the issue you just mentioned, that people just feel that the society has gotten out of balance, that they don't like being governed by people who don't have their interests at heart, and they'd like to see that change. And I think that's an enormously good first step. As far as Europe is concerned, I do a lot of work on Europe, and I actually don't share the view. I know many people feel this way, that Europe is dramatically more egalitarian than we are. The inequalities in Europe are just distributed in a different way. And Europe has a tradition, particularly in North Europe, of being very egalitarian. But that's only a piece of the whole picture. Europe is this big collection of now 25 countries. And some of them, particularly the East European countries and the Mediterranean countries, are much poorer than Germany or France, for that matter. That's an amazingly big problem in Europe now. It's very much like the problem that the United States had between the Civil War and the New Deal, when the Deep South was really deeply impoverished compared to the Industrial North. And what the New Deal did and what Lyndon Johnson's Great Society did was to put in place a process whereby states like Texas, which perhaps, you know, had half the average income of New York 70 years ago, now it's 85-90%, and the country is very much more regionally balanced and integrated than it was. So there are some actual success stories that say, look, you put a policy in place and you follow it consistently for 60 years, you can accomplish something, and the shape of the country begins to change. So from that point of view, I'm a little more optimistic than some of the people I'm normally allied with politically.
So the inequality that exists in Europe that we sort of gloss over when we look at it from this side of the Atlantic is that it goes from country to country as opposed to household
right.
to household.
You're right. It's Poland is 60 miles from Berlin and a very much lower income. And as a result, you have huge migration across the borders as people from the poorer regions of Europe look for jobs in the richer regions. And as a result of that, you have a lot more unemployment because it's a lot more people looking for jobs than they can actually provide.
We have an email from Jeff in Carrollton who writes, "Our discussions of the immigration crisis and arguments against doing anything about climate change also scare tactics in the same way that the questions about Social Security are."
In the case of immigration, I think to some degree, yes. I think immigration has a very strong political component. To me, the reality behind immigration is that, now, this is something my colleague Ray Marshall, who was Labor Secretary in the Carter administration, impressed on me. Our labor force grows as a result of immigration. We're going to be relying on people coming in for the foreseeable future to fill the jobs that we create and that we need to have done. So the only issue is, when are people who are in that position going to enjoy political rights in their country? They're going to be here for a long time.
Let me have you pause there, and we'll get the rest of that answer and maybe talk about climate change after the break. My guest is James Galbraith. His book is called The Predator State. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is James Galbraith. He's Lloyd Benson Chair in Government and Business Relations at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at UT. His new book is called The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandoned the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. The second half of Jeff's email question, James, was about people who resist efforts to mitigate climate change.
Could I just finish the thought I had on immigration?
Of course, yeah.
The point I wanted to make about that was that, as I say, immigrants are going to be here a long time. It's the nature of our economy. People come to work, and once they fill a job, they're likely to stay. So the question was, how long does it take before we recognize that if they want political rights, they should have them? Their children will have political rights, will be citizens, if they're born in the United States. And so within 20 or 25 years, that community is going to be a community of citizens. The question is, do you want to make that time a little bit shorter? It seems to me to be eminently reasonable, and that should be the way in which the problem is approached. It's never going to be the case that we're going to keep people out because we need them. And secondly, if we try to cycle them through as temporary workers programs, you're just creating all kinds of problems, because what you don't want to have is a community of people who think they're only going to be around for 3 or 5 years, and then they're going to get kicked out. They'll have no stake in respecting or building the institutions, and you'll have all kinds of social issues. So,
continue, and then I have a follow-up question.
Okay, that's the thought on immigration. It seems to me just a fact of life, perhaps since my father was an immigrant from Canada, my wife's an immigrant from China, I may have some bias on this question, but it just seems to me, dude, that's the realistic view, and people should resist efforts to make them feared about it. It's been the way the country has worked since the beginning, and it's worked pretty well.
And from an economic standpoint, as participants in the market, is there any difference whatsoever? Are immigrants indistinguishable from native-born Americans?
Well, they become so in a very short period of time. A generation just isn't very long. And yes, the country changes, but the country is always changing. And the crucial thing from the country's point of view is to develop a community which is based on our political values, which I think have universal appeal, and secondly, which has the American spirit of cooperative problem solving, which is something which could bring us to the next question I know you want to ask, which is about climate change.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, Jeff's question was whether or not that is also sort of a scare tactic, people who think that there nothing should be done about climate change.
I think there's an element here, a strong element of economic competition. If you're an oil company or coal company, you're happy with a very high price, but the last thing you want is a lot of competition to your product or a serious understanding that conservation, not burning, is the first and most essential major step toward mitigating climate change. People need to realize this is a challenge we can't escape. The city of Houston is only 10 feet above sea level. If the half of Greenland and West Antarctica were to melt, the seas would rise by 20 feet. We wouldn't have that anymore. It's hard to imagine how much life could be disrupted by that kind of disaster. We need to get cracking to meet the goals for reduction of greenhouse gases. And we can, I think, I have to believe that if we put our minds to it, we could do it. Not only could we do it, we'd do it in a way in which most people would actually be better off over time, and where the country as a whole could be employed for a generation, reconfiguring our way of life in such a way that that we meet this challenge in a way which is the least painful and the most effective. That's essentially, we have to be able to do that. And in order to be able to do that, we need to have a government which can think clearly and independently about the best way to do it. And that, I think, means creating new institutions, as well as building up in our universities and our research labs all kinds of capacity to think about these questions in an applied way that we don't now have.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Gary in Dallas. Hello, Gary.
Hello, yes. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
The question I have, and I hope it's not out of range here, is about the Marshall Plan. And is it still active, you know, the Marshall Plan that we had to rebuild other countries after World War II? Is it active anywhere?
Well, the Marshall Plan lasted from 1947, I guess it was announced, into the earlier mid-1950s, at which point the Europeans were sufficiently recovered that they no longer needed the kind of direct financial transfer from us that put it in place. But the idea that you have a challenge which can't be avoided, and which you really have to step up to the plate and do things on the scale that's required, that's very much the idea of the Marshall Plan. It was the idea of the Manhattan Project. And it seems to me it's something which is in our social history, our DNA, if you like, something that we can do. It's very hard to see another example of another country that has achieved this, particularly on the international scale in modern times. So I think it's our job.
We know about the billions of dollars that the U.S. government is spending on the war in Iraq. What do you think will happen to the economy when the large corporations that are profiting handsomely from their involvement with the war as private contractors no longer have that source of revenue?
It's actually the direct expenditures on the war. If we cut them out tomorrow, we could absorb that in new activity in a very short period of time. It is just not that big a deal, 1 or 2% of GDP. Put together an investment boom in, let's say, alternative energy and rebuilding our own infrastructure, and everybody would be back to work, and we would have something to show for it in the form of improved living standards over time. So I'm not worried about that for a moment. The right thing to do in Iraq is what is right to do to get us out of Iraq in an orderly way with the least possible additional damage to that very damaged society.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're talking today to James K. Galbraith. His new book is called The Predator State. Let's go next to Hugh in Richardson. Hi, Hugh.
Hello.
Hello, Hugh.
Yes, I wanted to ask the professor about the Fair Trades Act of 1923, which doesn't seem to be enforced nowadays, and there's been some court decisions saying it was antiquated. And does he feel like there is any value in the Fair Trades Act of 1923?
Thanks for your call.
Fair Trade Act of 1923, I have to take a pass. I don't know what it is.
Okay, we will move on. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number, or you can send email to think@kera.org. What kind of remedies, James, exist right now to end the predator state before it sort of ends itself and fails entirely?
Well, I think if we get a new administration in January of 2009, one of the first tasks will be to clean out the regulatory apparatus so that it is staffed and led by people who are independent, not by zealots, but by people who have an independent perspective and are not entirely working for the industries that they regulate. I think that would be the crucial first step that a future president can take. Secondly, we have to be aware that the government has been downsized and outsourced to the point where crucial functions are no longer really being performed, and so an inventory will be required of what's necessary. And that again is going to be a project for assuring that that everything from their traffic control to the management of the national parks, to surveying of floodplains, I mean, of practical things, to the challenges of energy policy, have adequate and competent personnel in charge. The government's going to need to think about how it thinks, about how it goes forward and addresses in an orderly way the major technical challenges. And I think we have to think a little bit more about where we stand in the world. We're not, unlike 1933 when Franklin Roosevelt came in, the U.S. is not a completely autonomous and dominant financial power anymore. We'll have to worry a little bit more about some of the fragility of the world financial system that's been allowed to develop in the last decade or so.
An email from Kelly in Dallas asks, where on the free market spectrum should we place energy and petrochemical industries? The best, easiest, least painful solution to all our fossil fuel woes would be price-induced conservation. Would it be wise to stop energy subsidies?
Well, we have, of course, a very high price for oil right now. And the problem is that that's a price which is set somewhere between Saudi Arabia, which is the swing producer, and unregulated futures markets, largely in London and other places, to which our regulation has allowed them to escape. The problem with the very high price is that it's not stable. And anybody who builds an alternative energy scheme on the idea that oil is going to stay at $140 is likely to come into a rude surprise, because a purely speculative bubble in oil prices is likely to end. And I think, in fact, we may see some signs now that it is already ending. So what we need is price is a very important element of this, but we need to have a price which is provides the right incentives, at the same time is realistic, and not so high that it constitutes a huge uncompensated tax on commuters and other and on lower income people who are entirely dependent upon their cars. So it's a very delicate balancing act, but long-term stability is obviously got to be the crucial thing if you're going to make an energy transformation.
James, as an economist with a sense of social responsibility, how do you decide where it's appropriate to intervene with additional market regulation and on what industries to sort of stand aside and let them go on their own?
I think it's a very interesting question, and it's one that largely has to be approached case by case. What regulations and standards do is they protect the interest of the consumer where the consumer cannot protect their own interest, where sophisticated technologies or biology is concerned. You need to have a watchdog, and that's a vital area. That still leaves enormous range for the creativity of private entrepreneurs, enormous range for the growth of private business, and if you have restore stable credit conditions, you can have a very thriving private economy. A lot of things, you know, for example, the growth of the economy in the late 1990s in the information technology area was substantially unregulated and involved a huge amount of money, a huge amount of creativity and wealth creation. And I have no complaints about that, except that the financial mechanisms that made it possible could not be sustained, and the whole thing came to a very premature crashing halt.
Is it possible in a science like economics to practice it and believe in any kind of absolute truth?
I think absolute truths are dangerous in social science. Social science is very relational. It's about my relationship to you, our relationship to each other. And we need to really be careful to think. You get a lot further if you start from the beginning thinking in those terms and not thinking that one ideological solution is always better, whether that's a centralized or a decentralized solution.
Have we made that mistake, do you think, in the past few years?
Certainly from the standpoint of our thinking. I don't think we've ever made it as a country as seriously as some other countries have. We've had for several generations a pretty effective mixed system, and our challenge now is to restore it, get back a balance which has been lost. If we continue to lose it and go down this path, then we could be in very, very serious trouble in a short period of time.
James K. Galbraith is Lloyd Benson Chair in Government and Business Relations at UT Austin's LBJ School of Public Affairs. His new book is called The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandoned the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. James, it's been a great discussion. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.